Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Varca with co-host, teacher and socialist Andy Lipson and community organizer and socialist Kenny Cepeda. We are online at what-s-left.webno.com. Today we have a special guest with us, socialist AJ, with whom we will discuss a wide range of topics. Such as socialism, sexism, and issues in public education, which I'm really looking forward to. AJ Johnston is a revolutionary socialist and a public high school math teacher in San Francisco. She has published, along with Andy, a number of articles on counterpunch.org about issues of education and union politics. She also co-authored a chapter in the 2012 collection Education and Capitalism, Struggles for Learning and Liberation. Welcome, AJ.
Hi, thank you. I'm really happy to be here. I'm excited.
Well, I've heard a lot about you, and finally we can have you on because Andy raves about you a lot. So maybe we actually could start right there with Andy so he could share with us your connection, your work together, just the collaboration that you both have had in the past, and why you invited AJ today, Andy.
Yeah, I mean, when you and I first started What's Left, I think interviewing people like AJ was, and people like Brian were some of the people who I'd really thought about wanting. If we ever got anywhere, if we continued with this, these are the kinds of people I really wanted to. People to hear from, to the extent that we have an audience. And AJ was a fellow comrade in the ISO together, and we did a lot of close work together in education and just in everything we were doing in the ISO, in trying to run the branch and things like that. And she played a large role in my political development as a Marxist, and also a large role in getting out of that organization, which was a very necessary step for me. But really, her biggest role in my life has been after the ISO, where she was really central in me kind of, once you take that walk into the wilderness, you don't really have anybody else to do and to figure out what's going on. And AJ was central in keeping me politically alive during that time, and helping me think through, what do I think it means to be a socialist? What do I think it means to be a Marxist, a revolutionary, and a worker? People like Brian and AJ have acted as kind of a political compass for me for all my life, that I've been politically active. And so when she kind of approached me and said, "Hey, I think I'm ready to do an interview," I was like, "Let's do it," you know? And so I'm really curious what she'll have to say today, and very grateful, AJ, for you being willing to do this.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much. I'm super excited to talk about all of these topics, and I'm glad that I finally made the decision to be here.
Go ahead, Kenny, sorry.
Can we maybe start with a little background? Tell us where you're from and maybe how you got to socialism, just to start.
Mm-hmm. I'm from Virginia originally, so I think for most people, anybody who ends up being 3,000 miles away from their family, there's like a story there. for me, that story of ending up out here in California was not the beginning of my story to socialism. I actually, I was the kind of person who was very angry about being poor, and very curious about why the world was as divided as it was. And so when I went to college, and my experience through school, I think, was a big part of me kind of asking questions about why the world was the way it was, because all the way through middle high school and into college, I was a kid on full scholarship, surrounded by people with a lot of wealth and a lot of opportunity, and I was really angry about that, and also really ashamed of that, really ashamed of my position in those spaces, and you know, really ashamed of all of the times that, like, I couldn't fully participate in those communities because I didn't have, you know, money. You know, when I was in school, I remember having to go to a teacher because it was like, you know, at these private schools, you have things like ski day where everybody takes a day off and goes skiing. And I remember going to the head of school and saying that I couldn't come because I didn't have, you know, $20 for the lift ticket, and being told that I shouldn't be at that school if I didn't have $20 for the lift ticket to go to ski day. And just kind of like those little, just the little insults and injustices all along the way. When I got to college in New York, I was really, really angry. And I was working full time and going to school full time. The ISO was there, you know, like at a club day. And I walked up to that table and was like, oh, socialism, it explains everything about why I'm so angry and why the world is the way it is. And you signed me up. I think I joined within like a week. And this would have been in 1994. So I considered myself a socialist when I was in college. For a few years, but my personal story took kind of a weird path, and I left the ISO. But I ended up in California in 1999, and what brought me back into politics was the Second Gulf War. After, you know, I sort of held on to this idea of myself as a revolutionary and a socialist, even though I hadn't been organizing with anyone. And after September 11th, and then after the war started in the fall, I found myself going to protests. I needed to kind of get out there. And I remember going to a protest and running into a table. It was the ISO table, the protest and civic center. And I was like, oh my God, it's still, you know, it exists. Like, it wasn't just this thing in New York, you know, it's still around. Again, it was very, very quick within a few months. Andy was one of the first people that I remember talking to. There were a few comrades who I remember sitting down with in those early days and figuring out what the organization was like then. But it was that Second Gulf War. I'd been reading, you know, Chomsky. I've read Paul Farmer about Haiti and just sort of like questions around imperialism and around sort of my terror at the world, what I thought, like the world being thrown into war again, was what brought me back around to socialism.
Do you still consider yourself a socialist? I mean, you left the ISO, and where are you now in terms of your politics?
Yeah, I definitely consider myself a socialist. I describe myself as a revolutionary socialist. I'm very happy to say that the ISO did not take my socialism from me. I was a member of that group until 2011 was when I finally stopped paying dues and left. In 2010, that last year, 2011, I mean, it has been a long, long process of leaving. Leaving was not kind of like I stopped paying dues and I was fine and I just kept going. I mean, in some ways, I feel like I've had to fight very hard to hold on to that and sort of figure out what, you know, what are still my politics and what are things that I feel like are still hangovers from my time in that organization and what are the things that I want to keep and what are the things I want to get rid of. Because I learned so much during that time that I was active. I mean, I lived so much life. I did so much activity. My work, you know, just from organizing, learning how to put people and things and actions together, my political education, the work I did with Andy in my union and in education, you know, I can't say enough about how much I learned during that time, but there's also been a lot that I still am trying to figure out and unlearn, but the core of it, my revolutionary social politics are still the core, for sure.
Can you maybe say a little more about that, what being a revolutionary socialist means to you?
Yeah. To me, it's change from below. It's not looking for any social change to happen from politicians, from elections, from voting for parties. It is, it's materialism. It's kind of, you know, I think of that the ideas and the experiences and the way we live our life comes from the way that society is set up. You know, that we're not inborn with any sort of set of ideas, and the ideas that we do develop, you know, come out of our lived experience, and that includes all of the really bad ideas, racism, sexism, and homophobia, and anti-immigrant hysteria, Islamophobia, I mean, you name it, all of those things come out of a structure and a society that's built to profit off of those ideas and off of us continuing to have those ideas. So since those ideas come from that structure, I think changing that structure is the key to changing the world. I think one thing that has been difficult for me in sort of losing my grounding as an organized revolutionary socialist with a group and a party has been that it has done damage to my confidence in the idea of the possibility for the working class to be able to create change in this world. So those things were so enmeshed for me, like the success of my organization, the success of the work in the organization, and sometimes so cloudy for me to be able to see, you know, oh, we had this really great rally. That must mean like the working class is making great strides. You know, these two ideas got so muddied for me that I do feel like my confidence in the possibility for us to have a better world has been shaken. And it's not just from having left the ISO. It's also from the fact that we have like such incredible lack of working class struggle around us. You know, I'm not going to blame it all on my time in the ISO, but those two things got a little bit muddy. But the thing that was so magical about maybe socialism was like that unlocked the possibility. We don't just explain why the world is the way it is. It also says that there is the possibility for there to be no racism, no sexism, no homophobia, no starvation, that there is plenty in the world. And that if the people who create it take control of it, then we could actually create an entire new society and way of living. That piece to me, is really key, and I do still believe it, although I don't have the same sort of hope for seeing fundamental change in my lifetime that I did for a lot of my life.
You did an episode some while back on it was titled Confessions of a Former ISO Member with Andy. I'm not sure if you took a look at that, but it was one of the most popular videos / episodes that we did, just that we did on this show. I mean, I think we even had people in college studying the ISO, using it as a reference. But I remember they were in the comment section. Some people were using it as that. But you were in the ISO, and What do you make of the downfall of the organization? I know you mentioned a little bit about it, but personally, have you known those people, the relationships you had built with them, and the scandal that was sort of their doing of their downfall? What part of it? I mean, it could have been other things as well. I'm just one of the things that was prominent in many articles was the scandals of sexism within those. The organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I will say that from the time that I left to the time when that collapse happened, you know, I was not somebody who kind of followed what was going on with the organization that I had left. I was, unlike some of my other fellow comrades who left, I didn't continue to read the paper or stay in touch with people who were still in the group or figure out what was going on. So for me, it was kind of like this gap, and then this. But trust me, I was back in it as soon as everything started to fall apart. You know, I wanted to go, and because a lot of it was related, you know, this was a process that was drawn out over years. And some of the scandals that were written about, you know, were things that happened around the time that I was in. And I do think some of them, and to be honest, like given the fact where that organization was, which I think was always saying that things were well in advance of what they were, was always telling us that we were like just on the cusp of, you know, the next big thing. And that if we could just like get out there next to the best activists and sort of like say maybe the next step, we could like get all these people. And if we could just build our organization, that was going to be like the key thing to helping the class move forward. You know, given that that's kind of where things were when I left, and given that we did not have working class revolution in this country, we didn't even have like a gigantic strike wave or anything like that, I can only imagine that that story just continued to be told over and over and over again. And I don't think that I know that because I experience that it does not breed a very good internal culture to have people just continually figuring out how to sort of like tell the same story over and over and over again and get the next line of leading members, you know, lined up to tell the story to the next line of leading members. And to, we're not here to have a discussion with you. We're not here to find out what you think and have an interchange. We're here to deliver the line. And then once you're convinced, you're going to go down and deliver it to the branch and then to the fraction and into the club on your campus. That was the culture that I participated in. That was the experience that we had, and finally became like just very very intolerable. I mean, when I look back on those last years, 2010 2011, I mean, for one thing, I'll just say it's a miracle that that Andy and I sit here, and I still consider him a dear friend and close comrade today. The strain that our personal and political relationship was put under during those years was horrible. It was a very, very difficult period in my life. You know, the last convention that I went to, for the ISO would have been in February 2011, and I was taken aside, you know, by national leadership at that time, and, you know, listened to and taken out for drinks and dinner, and like, you know, the whole atmosphere then was like, let's just get these experienced members, and we're all each going to try to like pick them off and have little buddy buddy conversations with them and try to, you know, bring them closer to us, and we're going to try to weed this out one by one. And they were successful in doing that, really. I mean, in the end, the fracture between the group of us in San Francisco that were asking questions and had real doubts about the way things were going, they did drive wedges between us. They did fracture personal and political relationships. And I'm very, very grateful that we have been able to put those back together. And that has been through a process of continuing to talk about the politics and the problems that we saw in the ISO and what we see is going on today, trying to make sense of them together. I think that those things have been totally related in how we've been able to put our personal relationships back together. And there's just, you know, the people that I consider my closest comrades now, we don't agree on necessarily everything, how we understand the world or even what we think should be happening. And the fact that that is okay, that was just completely not the way that I was trained to lead in the ISO. That would have been like, you just got to go around and hammer down all the arguments until everything was on the same plane. It was not good.
Wow. That's just giving me PTSD. Just hearing that. In a similar question, I think you've already answered one of them. In terms of what were the, so one of the key things you unlearned was having to hammer down every argument and learning how to have a sustained argument, disagreement with a comrade, with an ally, and just carry it forward and to see if it takes you in the same direction or not. So I think that's one thing that you and I think unlearned. Can you say anything else that you recognize that you had to unlearn from that time, that you had to kind of like cast aside and say, no, that doesn't work?
I guess two things sort of come to mind. One is definitely, you know, one is just this question of like, I think about it through my relationship to the people at work, you know, and the work that I do in my union at my school site or as shop steward at my school site. It's related to what you just said. You know, my job is just to continue to be along and struggle with these folks. Like, my main job at work in my union with my fellow union members is not to convince them all of, like, my way of thinking and then let's all act in that direction. I have to allow for people to surprise me and for their minds to change in ways that I wouldn't expect, and for those ideas to come from, you know, to sometimes come from not the people that you would expect. So I think that one thing that I had learned was kind of like trying to, you know, checklist people's politics as sort of like this long list of how close they were to socialism based on like kind of sort of where they stood on a number of issues. You know, the working class being the agent of change is sort of the last one on the list. Like, can we get them there? Like a stair step approach. And I think since, you know, my time of not being, of being out of that and just kind of trying to figure this stuff out with you, Andy, and on my own, is that that's not necessarily the way it works. And I've been able to have, I think, more space to see the way people's ideas can fluctuate very quickly, especially because we don't have any kind of ongoing developing working class struggle in this country. Things can sort of shoot into one direction, swing back in the other way. But to not sort of decide like who are the good people and who are the bad people in terms of their ideas at my work site, but to always think about sort of being alive to the possibility of people's ideas changing very quickly or being so contradictory that they might take action in a direction that I wouldn't expect. I think the other thing is definitely about like this idea of how we relate to liberalism and to reform movements, for sure. I mean, I can remember, as much as I never for a second was going to think about voting for a Democrat or think about voting for Obama, you know, there was still this idea in the ISO. We were still like kind of excited that Obama won, you know, it was like still it kind of was like, this is exciting because this is going to mean something. And, you know, this is going to be great how this is going to expose the Democratic Party because he's like the greatest Democratic candidate to exist in our lifetime. And then he's going to be a disappointment. And then people are going to figure out socialism. So we got to sort of be with people in their enthusiasm. I don't believe that anymore. Being with people and their enthusiasm for liberalism to me just feels at this point like dishonesty. I actually feel like most of the time, most of the most difficult and tricky arguments for me to learn to navigate now are arguments with people who are very committed to, you know, progressive or liberal politics. That those are the hardest arguments to have for me. It's a lot harder to argue with someone about identity politics or about, you know, Chesa Boudin's election here in San Francisco to be DA, you know, to have like those kind of arguments with people as opposed to, you know, arguing against like Trump. Like, that's not hard, you know. So honesty, I guess, is just saying exactly what I think as a socialist, not kind of like, I'll tell you what I think later after I kind of agree with you about voting for this proposition or this reform or maybe this Green Party candidate.
Yeah.
I don't do that anymore.
So can you talk more about that period after the ISO, some of the work we did, and then just some of, can you talk mm-hmm. about what that was like? Maybe more you learned out of it and maybe some of the difficulties of it. What was that experience like on your own and that work post ISO?
It was a very, very, I mean, it has been so hard for me to get back involved as thinking of myself as someone who was politically active. When I first left, I couldn't go to a protest. I couldn't go to a demonstration. I couldn't go to a march. I couldn't, you know, go to a union meeting. I just couldn't. I didn't want to deal with running into comrades. I didn't want to deal with, you know, what felt like the same old set of arguments over and over again. I grieved for a very long time. I mean, I woke up every single day thinking about what am I going to do today for the ISO and like to advance working class revolution. It organized my entire life for over a decade, you know, it was everything. And so I was just very, very sad for a very, very long time. And couldn't really figure out what I wanted to do, you know? And I still don't think I have the answer to that, but I am a member of the working class. I'm a member of the organized working class. I consider myself lucky to, you know, still have a union and still be part of that tradition, even with all of its problems. And so, you know, continuing to be an organized teacher has been the thing that I think has kept me moving forward and kept me thinking about things. You know, the Reform Caucus that Andy and I were both a member of was another piece of loss. The EDU, Educators for Democratic Union, that we both participated in starting. You know, that was something else that it was another loss for me when that fell apart and we couldn't kind of figure out. Well, we tried. I think we did. You know, I think the conversations that Andy and I had during that time about what does it mean when we had a member of this caucus, you know, get elected president of our union. A couple members of the caucus got elected into positions, and then a whole bunch of the people who ran in our caucus did not get elected. And so once we were found in this position of not really having had the endorsement of the people who voted, of not really having our caucus be in control of the union, having sort of this split situation, it really fractured that group. I learned a lot through that defeat, though. I saw how the power, like, I saw so strongly how the entrenched power of the union bureaucracy, like, the hold that has on people. I was so glad I never got elected when I ran for president. That would have been a disaster for me.
Yeah.
I saw what happens to really, you know, strong union activists when you don't have a base underneath you, like pushing you, and you don't even have a caucus underneath you that's willing to hold you accountable to what the caucus supposedly believes anymore. Like how much that can pull on somebody to just be pulled back into reformism. So the experience of kind of continuing to try to keep that caucus moving forward once I was not an organized socialist anymore, and then Andy and I were kind of just, you know, we would talk some, but I was pulling farther and farther away from activity. Was hard, but I feel like I learned a lot through that. Else have I learned in these last few years? I don't know. I'll stop there.
Yeah. AJ, if I could, I remember you in one of those meetings at the San Francisco Public Library at Glen Park. When you both had those meetings, I was quiet though.
Oh, uh-huh.
You, caucus, you might have remembered me, but uh-huh. I was there.
Yeah, I do. In the room, in the little circle on the rug, in the little like preschool rug. Yeah.
Anyhow, I remember Andy's run for vice president. In the union. So I feel so I feel disheartened that none of you could, the EDU members didn't, the caucus didn't get anybody much in high positions of the union to be able to do anything transformative. So anyhow.
Well, you know, but it was one of those things, you know, it's similar to what we're dealing, I think it's very similar to what we're kind of facing right now. It's like, we were a good group of folks trying to figure out how to pull, you know, people in our union into activity, and not explicitly then towards strike as much as I think, you know, we could have or should have. But even now, you know, the group that the sort of left-wing group, Strike Ready SF, that Andy has talked about before, you know, it's the same kind of thing of, you know, we've got these two dozen people maybe, you know, like actively in this conversation. But you know, we can't mistake that for like being ready to, you know, go out on strike next week, but nor does that mean there's nothing for us to do, right? Or nor does that mean we should change what we're saying we think needs to happen. Mm-hmm. Yes, we still actually need to be on strike. We still actually need to strike and shut this system down. But there's, you know, I think in EDU, we struggled to actually always say exactly what we thought needed to happen and tried to figure out like what was the thing that we thought was more reasonable. And I think, you know, now sometimes, I mean, that I think still exists, but I also think there's a struggle between like knowing that that's what needs to happen and thinking like maybe we can figure out a way to make that happen in the next, you know, 3 weeks before school starts. That kind of, maybe we can spark it.
Yeah.
So this is a confusing time to be a public education teacher and radical and activist. Mm-hmm. You and I have had some conversations about this moment. I guess I'm just going to ask you to like riff on what this means for you right now as we are being asked to enter into distance learning, as we're asked to be to talk about potentially contact tracing ourselves and our students, as we recognize that there's a big austerity thing coming, and we're going forward into a kind of schooling that I think both you and I are very like just doesn't feel like the right thing to be doing. Maybe just talk about what this is like right now for you and what this, well, first that.
Okay, cut me off because I could probably go on about this forever. Man, I mean, it is a depressing time to be a teacher. Oh, gosh. Distance learning, I gotta do that. I mean, I don't even know how to talk about things anymore. It's like I go to meetings and we have distance learning. Like nothing is, I need new words. There's no learning. It's not distance learning. There's no learning happening. It's not education. It's disgusting. It's personally very upsetting to me. Very, very, very upsetting that we find ourselves in this position right now. My mind is continually like trying to catch up with reality because, you know, when I walked out of school on whatever it was, March 13th, you know, I thought I was coming back in 2 weeks. You know, when I went back to in the building to get my printer so I could print stuff like in April, I thought for sure I'd be back in August. You know, I can't sometimes catch up with what is really happening. I'm extremely dismayed about us not going back into buildings in August. I do not for one second believe that we could not go back into buildings in August. I think that there is plenty of money, ingenuity, and unemployed human power that could make this work if that's what we wanted to do, was get back into buildings and have people together in communities trying to learn together. I believe there is money and smarts in a plenty to do that. And I think that the reason that it is not happening, I think there's a number of reasons that it's not happening. In no particular order, I think that it is really, I mean, it's really, really, really a time when the ruling class is seeing exactly how far they can push the working class. How much can they push off onto us? How much can they get us to continue to further, like, increase their profits by subsidizing every last thing with our blood, sweat, and tears, keeping kids home for school, no longer providing daycare, no longer providing schooling, transportation, meals at the same level, healthcare, electricity, we're paying our bosses electric bills when we work at home, our water, our power. I mean, it's just disgusting to me how much is being pushed off onto the working class right now. And they're going to do it until we don't let them do it anymore. I also think that it continues to really help just feed this narrative of fear and isolation. As teachers, we're now like, you know, the last holdout of the largest organized part of the working class in this country. And you have now essentially atomized us and made us take in work in our homes individually anymore. I mean, we can't even get together in the same room to have a union meeting anymore. I gotta Zoom it, you know? The impact, like, psychologically on us, like, how atomizing and isolating it is, how alienating it is to sit in front of a video screen and talk to people. I watch it in myself, in my coworkers. our ability to even like connect with each other as workers and give a shit about what the other person is going through has decreased. The amount of gossiping and, you know, backstabbing and sniping amongst people, it increases because this is not the way it happened. We're not sharing the same physical space. We're not sharing the same context. We're not sharing the same daily experience where we can, you know, go around the corner and say to our coworker, "Oh, did you see what happened down in the hall this morning?" I mean, all of these things are being taken away from us, taken away from our students, taken away from the whole school communities. It's very, very dangerous. I'm very worried about where this is going to go. You know, I definitely think that long term, that this has been the plan for the last 20 years, about moving as much sort of privatization, first through like charters and vouchers and things like that, privatizing public education. I think distance learning and educational technology is another just gigantic opportunity for public education to be privatized, for teachers' work to be sped up, for us to be asked to handle more students, for us to be able to ask to just sort of manage a data flow rather than sort of design lessons. It's a continued de-skilling of our work that has happened over the last 20 years, first from like the introduction of standardized curriculum and having people sort of like teach from the same textbook and teach the same thing and use the same standardized assessments. This is just like another next level of that. That also, as you talked about on here before, you know, is providing a massive data source for these companies and for whoever else might want to get their hands on it. You know, every last thing that our students touch, they have to sign into, you know, it's disgusting. I want to go back to work because I want to be with my students. Like, I dream about school almost every night. I dream about missing students. I dream about like students that I taught 20 years ago. And, you know, I want to be back in community. The only part of my job I like, it's the only part of my job I like is my students and having that interaction with them and designing things that get them excited or interested or thinking, whoa, I did this. You know, that's the only payoff I get other than the ability to pay my bills. And that has been taken from me because it doesn't happen in this format at all. Anybody who says it does, I would say they've had some really terrible experiences in the classroom because this is not it. And it's a disaster.
I would just want to add, it's even the struggle with the students that we struggle with, like that, the kinds of things, like I'm, and I don't mean I'm missing the out-of-pocket behavior. It's not, I do miss that, but the struggle you go into with those students when you're trying to kind of bring them in and stuff like that, you can't have that online. People just check out.
Just have a quick question. What do you teach, if you don't mind telling us?
I teach math at an alternative high school, and most of our students are, you know, credit deficient, or they have, you know, they may have been incarcerated, or they have sort of health and emotional problems that have kept them from attending school regularly. So I teach math almost, I would say 98% to students who have had a lot of math failure and hate math. You know, which you may think describes much of the population, but so I love what I do because it's really fun and challenging, and I get to work with people who say, like, I can't believe this is math, what we're doing, and, you know, I thought I would always hate it, and this is interesting. I have a lot of, I'm fortunate to have a lot of freedom for creativity in the way that I teach because we're an alternative high school because of the students that we have.
This is more of a rhetorical question, but I'm curious as to what is it with science and socialists? I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's a very interesting question. I don't think it's rhetorical at all. I taught from second grade all the way to 12th grade. I've been teaching math for only 3 years. I've taught middle school. I've taught social studies. I've taught science. I taught social studies and science. But I think it's an interesting question.
It might be materialism, like just feeling like there's a physical explanation for what's actually taking place. And science is not just about understanding the world. It is about changing the world with using predict, like Eric Lerner talked about, you know, and I think there is a connection there a little bit. So two questions, AJ. The first one is, so I have been talking about not being trying to navigate the, I don't want to move forward into the new normal. And I know we can't go back to that old normal because they are both capitalist traps. And I've, the only way I know to say is that we have to have a socialist revolution. We have to have a strike that spreads a strike that leads to a social, that's the only answer I can come up with. How do you, what kind of answer do you provide for yourself for what to say at this moment? And it might be going back to the classroom, but under certain circumstances, you know, so how do you, what's the answer you provide for yourself right now as to what we should do as educators?
I'm definitely, I don't know. So I'm okay with that. That's the space I'm in right now. It's like, I have no idea. I very much feel a conflict in this idea of like, okay, so you're telling me we can't go back to work. So then what's the answer to that? Then what would I say? Would I say, okay, let's all go out on strike to demand that we go back to school? Okay, that sounds weird. I can't quite get my head around like trying to convince my coworkers to strike, to go back to underfunded classrooms. You know, like I can't quite get my head around that. And then, you know, I look at some of the demands that have come out from like LA Unified, from some, the Strike Ready SF group here in San Francisco, putting out a set of demands, you know, for a just return. And so, you know, can I say, oh, we will return when, I don't want to go down the road of the defunding police argument right now. I can't, you know, it's like the same thing. It's like, can we then defund the police and fully fund education and provide, you know, free daycare for every student in the United States? And these are the terms on which I will go back to work. I still get myself sort of stuck in a trap there, because in my mind, when we go out on strike, it's for us to set the terms under which we go back to work. But it's really ultimately, it is about us saying we will go back to work when we get to decide exactly what happens. And there, it is, to me, it is just going to stay in the realm of pure propaganda to say things like, we're going to go back to work when there's, you know, free preschool for all, we've abolished all police departments, we have Medicare for all, we have, you know, ended all of the wars, brought all the troops home. You can't win those demands with just the teaching force going out on strike. You can't win those demands without general strike and workers taking power and moving towards socialist revolution. So I feel like you have to say that. I do feel like you have to say that rather than putting out this list of demands that then sort of, I guess, becomes just kind of like a... again, sort of becomes like a checklist for who's going to get organized under this banner. Because if we're actually talking about winning things, then we have to be talking about revolution. Otherwise, it's just, that's not the way it's going to happen, because capitalism needs all of those things to continue. So I don't know. I feel really, you know, conflicted about it. When I look at the fact that the vast, vast majority of the teachers are fully in agreement with this idea of we can't go back right now. And to me, that's where I'm for right now, because I don't know, I feel conflicted and don't know the answer to the bigger question and don't really feel, you know, that I can say, okay, so, you know, general strike now, time for the revolution. Right now, I feel like the most important thing is to just call bullshit on us not going back, or on saying that that's obviously like, please let me stay home because it's not safe. And I guess that's where I've landed for now, recognizing that it doesn't really feel like a complete answer to me.
I just wanted to say, I think I understand the sentiment of wanting to go back. And then I speak to teacher friends who have a very deep fear of going back. And I want to respect that. But at the same time, they're struggling having their children at home. They have their own children, and they know that being home isn't healthy. So right now I'm organizing with some of them to begin sort of a homeschooling project, because the kids are smaller. They're about 5 years. They're entering kindergarten. But I'm just thinking of all the different voices that exist within the teacher world. You know, that. Educators that want to go back, the educators who don't want to go back, the educators who want something in between. It's just a tumultuous time. So,
It really is, and we're very we're afraid. We're afraid of each other, and we're afraid of leaving our houses. And we're afraid of being in public spaces, and that's a hard place, I think, to start. Talking to people when we've all been very successfully convinced that this is a time to be afraid of each other and to be afraid of getting together. And, you know, on the flip side of that, I mean, that's how, like, case by case basis, what makes everybody feel safe that they can go back. But on the flip side of that, for so many people, staying home is not safe.
Yeah.
Right. Not safe. We know that, you know. Saying, I feel when I see that stay home, stay safe slogan up in people's windows and stuff, I feel like, you know, you're very lucky to be able to feel like that's true for you, because there's lots and lots of people that is one of the least safe places you could tell me to stay right now would be in my house, you know. So,
yeah.
It's difficult.
Yeah.
And there has to be space for people who, you know, it doesn't mean because we can go back, everybody must go back. There has to be space for people who, you know, legitimately don't want to go back. You know, the WNBA right now, I love basketball, starting on Saturday, you know, and players need to get medical exemptions. You can have reasons not to go back if it makes sense. You know, if you have reasons, you have legitimate reasons to be high risk populations and not want to be. It should be like that all the time, though, right?
Yep.
COVID or no COVID. Yeah.
And this has been something we've touched on in our episodes of What's Left, is how do we understand this virus? You know, like, I am curious. Mm-hmm. You know, both Kenny and I have talked about our skepticism about the narrative that's been put out there about it. I'm curious how. Where do you land on some of these questions around how do you understand this moment of pandemic and virus? What do you believe? What are you not sure of? If there's anything you want to say about that.
Well, I am sure that whatever is happening is serving capitalism first and people's needs last. I'm sure of that. So that makes me incredibly skeptical. I think that there is a virus. People get sick from it. People get very sick from it. People die from it. I am sure that there's very minimal spread amongst young children and from young children to adults. I know that lots and lots of people who have been, who because of the kind of work they do, have not been able to stay home and work from home. I know that those folks, Latino folks in the Bay Area, have been hardest hit. Black folks in the Bay Area have been hardest hit, as opposed to other folks who can stay home and work from home. So I know that this virus does not attack everyone equally, and that has nothing to do with genetics and everything to do with people's positions in society and the kind of work they do. But I also know that there have been massive protests in the streets without gigantic spikes in case numbers. I know that there, you know, regardless of it is most people don't have it. I know that. And I know that the resources to be able to allow people to move about safely and in ways that they feel comfortable are being held back, you know, not being equally distributed or not being prioritized. So it's all being, you know, very, very contained. I feel like it's all being very, very contained by the ruling class to both sort of really, really profit off of the, like, materially, legitimately dollar profit, but also ideologically profit off this idea that we are scary to each other and need to stay isolated and atomized. And there's no way that we can move towards a higher degree of militancy, organization in the working class if we continue to believe that and act in that way. There's no way. And there's lots and lots and lots of other dangerous things that threaten people's lives that is not this virus. You know, coming war, other illnesses, violence in the home, depression, anxiety. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And it's like that those things are not being held in the same conversation. They're not being balanced out because there's way too much to gain for the ruling class from continuing on this sort of narrative and from sort of pumping out this nonstop and constantly contradictory news stories, which just feed into the fear in the same way. Because what can you trust? And this says this, and the next day it says that. And oh my God, we can't believe anything. I should just stay home.
AJ, there's a topic that I have been meaning to discuss here on What's Left, and maybe we can use this opportunity to discuss it here with you. What do you make out of the Me Too movement that happened? I've been meaning to have this discussion on this and on What's Left, and maybe you could share with us your thoughts. What do you make of it?
I got some thoughts. the first thought I want to share is that there's a good, visceral feeling of satisfaction that comes from like calling men out on their sexist bullshit that I get how satisfying that is. Like, I don't know if y'all remember Tumblr. Okay. So there's like this Tumblr, about like taking pictures of men spreading their legs on the buses. I don't know if you saw it. I mean, it was so satisfying, right? I love it. You go around taking pictures of men who can't keep their knees together on a bus and like take up like 2 and 3 seats. Like, that feels so good. That bullshit makes you mad. Like, you gotta look at this shit every day. So this is great. Like, put their pictures on the internet, you know, like call those people out. Great. There's a way that I, you know, absent of genuine abortion rights, absent of equal pay, you know, absent of actual equality, living in a sexist planet. There's a way that stuff feels really good. And I'm just like starting with that most visible sort of part of like calling people out, which I know does not summarize the Me Too movement, but I did want to start there because there's a way that when you, without struggle around you, like that just feels good to see people like get called out for stuff, you know? And that, the problem is, yeah, then that sort of like, all of a sudden is like a movement or activism, right? For some people, like that's it, that's enough. Me Too, I mean, gosh, we could talk about this forever. So I'm trying to think about what are the things that I want to say that are most important. Holding people in power responsible for decisions that they make that harm women, people who identify as women, is really important. I do believe that is important. Weinstein, piece of shit, you know, like everything that happened to him bad, he deserves every bad thing that happens to him, you know, that people in power should be held accountable for the things that they do. I have some problems with activism when it stays on the internet when it becomes just about like naming people. I have problems with activism that becomes about getting people fired from their jobs, and seeing that as a sort of way to change sexism. We're just going to fire all the people who allow their actions, their sexist actions, to be seen and noticed. We're gonna fire all of them. It is problematic, not so much because people like Weinstein lose his job, but it's problematic when it becomes a way of like, okay, well, if that's what we're going to do to, you know, somebody who owns a bunch of corporations and has a bunch of employees, then let's just have that also be how we handle sexism amongst our folk in the working class. Let's call each other out and get each other fired. You know, my father getting fired from jobs certainly does not change his sexist mind and does not change his behavior. I'm not calling my dad a sexist. You know what I'm saying? I have a problem with that. It's like it's a person by person. It's an individualistic sort of approach to social change. Just one by one by one by one. I also have a problem with you know, that I definitely think that it is the critique that has been raised that Me Too, you know, gets started by women of color and then becomes like a conversation amongst like white power elites in Hollywood and in cultural production is problematic. So I don't call myself a feminist. White lady feminism is like, you know, it was like a real thing. And my revolutionary socialism doesn't need, like, it includes human liberation. I don't need feminism. I'm a revolutionary socialist. Feminism is something different. You know, I was saying before, like, one thing that's important to me about my socialism is that it's materialist. And my problem with one of the problems with a lot of the conversation around Me Too is that it's an idealistic approach to changing sexism. It's about changing people's minds, you know, punishing them or shaming them or calling them out, and then or that's going to somehow create change by changing ideas. And just that is, nothing has ever changed that way. Brown versus Board did not happen because people changed their minds. Roe v. Wade didn't happen because people changed their minds. We didn't get a 40-hour work week because bosses changed their minds. Like, nothing has ever changed that way. You have to actually force change through material conditions. You have to force. If we absolutely, immediately, tomorrow, across the board, every single person in the school got paid the same wage, that would change people's minds about the value of a teacher's work versus a para's work. That would change people's minds about the value of work that mostly people of color do, or women of color do mostly in our teaching versus mostly white women in our teaching profession. That would do more to change people's ideas about the value of it than calling people out or naming people's individual acts. But I feel the problem I have with it is that it just leaves out men. It just leaves men out of the equation and the solution. And it makes no space for there to be any conversation about the way that sexism destroys all of us. Mm-hmm. And it can't talk about how sexism destroys all people, no matter how you name your body, then there is no hope of us figuring out a way that we can organize together to smash capitalism. Really. As angry as I get about the shit on the bus, back when I wasn't scared to ride the bus for germs, you know, I know at the end of the day that I have to be on the picket line with all the men in my workplace, even if they said some really gross stuff. Even if they never be quiet at meetings, even if they talk way more of the terms than they should get, even if they say things about their female students I don't like, I'm going to have to convince them to walk a picket line with me.
But I would add that, but if men are not challenged around those ideas through the course of that struggle, then we will be divided. You know, so it isn't just like, well, you can just stay the way... Mm-hmm. Working class men are going to have to change But the area where more of us will be changed is through the struggle where we see we all need each other if we're going to win. And we won't arrive at that place where everyone gets that equal pay, which is what we do need to get to, unless we are engaged in that common struggle together. And we all are needed for that. And if we don't figure out some of these things that divide us ideologically, then we will lose. But I agree with you that the place where that is really the place where that question is really going to be engaged is in struggle. Will be through the strike. It's not just person by person points of light, kind of being isolated or even being just argued with, which I think is a healthier way to do it. But so I guess I'll just say that.
What kind of traction do you find around people, you know, with this set of ideas, you know, that basically kind of challenges the mainstream approach, right? I don't know if that question makes sense. Like, how easy is it to have a conversation about this with people that are ideologically maybe very rigid in liberal framework? Like, do you find yourself isolated?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, I definitely am isolated in that position, you know, and I think that, you know, that for the most part, people who, you know, are the folks sitting next to me in a meeting, calling that person out because, you know, you've already talked 3 times, like give somebody else a chance, something like that. You know, those kind of folks who are willing to take action against things that they see that they identify as racist, sexist, homophobic in the workplace and consider themselves progressive. And, you know, if I talk to them making this argument, there's a lot of like, yes, of course, capitalism and oh yeah, revolution, but right. It's never, it's always something that is not for the conversation to be had right now, you know? And because that's the way that people, I think, respond to it, what they're really saying is kind of never, you know, at the end of the day, like not now and actually not ever. This is what we've got. This is what we've got to work with. So this is as far as it can go.
Yeah, it almost like, I mean, I identify with that because it almost seems like capitalism is secondary or tertiary to the argument. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like in past episodes, I've at least made the critique that we think that by changing culture at the top, we can change culture fundamentally or power. I definitely identify with that. I was just curious about how maybe you deal with that or because, you know, I'm learning to navigate this. I'm relatively new in this, you know, socialist revolutionary frame of understanding the world. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm just curious as to how you deal with that and what lessons you've learned.
Well, I wish I had a magical answer. It's hard, right? I do find it kind of in some ways the hardest place to be stuck because, you know, for the people that I have, you know, I think there's a little bit of like, yeah, AJ, you're broken record shit about capitalism. It's kind of like, yeah, well, until it changes, I really don't know what else you want me to say. Like, still the problem. Capitalism, still the problem. I don't know. Those arguments, I think, you know, are just going to happen over a long time. You know, I don't think I'm going to win that particular argument. Again, I'm not going to win that particular argument just in the area of ideas. Like, it's only going to change because something's going to happen and somebody's going to see it. That's the only way I learned. You know, I feel like I've been lucky to have the experience of seeing people's ideas change pretty quickly through the course of, like, organizing a big protest, you know, some of the budget cut stuff that we organized back in 2010 that was, you know, that changed people's ideas pretty quickly. You know, the big sort of explosions around Day Without an Immigrant back in, what was it, 06 or something? You know, you could, when there a lot of people move really quickly. Otherwise, I don't think I'm going to just come up with the right way to argue it. Unfortunately, I wish I could.
We discussed a little bit about what happened as well in the ISO with
the scandals. Did you ever experience sexism in those circles, AJ?
Well, I mean, I think we all experience sexism every day from the moment we take our first breath, and probably in our dreams too. That's a difficult question to answer. Not the question you're asking, I know, but it colors every single breath we take and the way we walk down the street and talk and sit, you know. It's like, for you three as well as me, it's everywhere. Did I ever experience any sort of like
sexual harassment?
Overt sexual harassment or anything like that? No, I didn't. You know, as being like an out lesbian, I suppose one of the awesome benefits of being an out lesbian is that you can kind of, you know, a lot of men aren't trying to mess with you. in that way. You know, not to say that I would have otherwise, but nothing like that. But, you know, I can't say that I didn't see it. Around me. I saw stuff, you know, because just because you're in a revolutionary organization, you're still living in the same messed up world. You still got the same, you know, you may be more conscious of your ideas, where they came from. You may do more active battle with them. You may be able to be more aware of like taking certain actions, but you know, it's, we've all still got it.
Yeah. And you see it definitely, Todd, as, as another way of holding the working class divided and used in within the framework of capitalism, right? Like such as homophobia, as well as racism and all of those discriminatory practices within capitalism, within the framework of that they're used in capitalism, are very linked and tied to capitalism. They're not just separate, right?
Yeah, well, particularly with sexism, I think sexism, you know, is even more deeply rooted. I mean, my understanding of sexism, you know, the division in between gender, putting male on top of female, it predates capitalism. You know, it's older than all of those other things. Sexuality didn't exist, so you couldn't have homophobia. You know, like sexism arises much, much earlier with the, you know, original pieces of surplus. You know, when people finally have a little bit more than they need, what are we going to do with that surplus? How does that surplus get controlled? That's way predates capitalism, and that's when you first start to see a small group, you know, that comes to be the ruling class. Could just be somebody who has way more food than everybody else and is controlling the extra food. So how do you determine that? You got to know where the babies came from. So we got to keep track of women's fertility. So, I mean, I think Engels' work, Frederick Engels' work on the origin of private property, the origin of family and private property has, I think everybody should read it. It, you know, it has some legitimate criticisms that some of the things that he was working off were, you know, old and that there's better information now, but the fundamental idea that this division between men and women, with women being subjugated to men, much predates capitalism, which I think means it's going to be extremely deep-rooted. I don't think we can even conceive of all of the ways that it shapes our, on the entire planet, our everyday existence and every part of it. But absolutely, to what you said, I mean, it absolutely serves, now it serves capitalism, it serves the ruling class in the system that we have of global capitalism, and so that will have to be gotten rid of first before we can do the work together of trying to figure out how to root out all of the ways that the gender, that sexuality, that even the idea of biological sex has become so deeply rooted that it's distorted our ability to just be human with each other.
One question I'd have is, we've had an episode on identity politics, and we've been critical of identity politics here. I'm wondering if you, what your thoughts are about identity politics, and one area that has been more, even people who say I don't agree with identity politics, but intersectionality has been more popular on the left as a way of understanding oppression and relationship to class. I'm actually less familiar with that intersectionality stuff. I don't know how familiar you are. What can you say about either your thoughts on identity politics or intersectionality as having something to add to this discussion, or maybe it's not helpful? What are your thoughts on those things?
Well, identity politics first, to start with that, I think the way that it is functioning now is to, in order for capitalism to continue, right, here in the heart of the United States, fundamentally, white workers have to be divided from people of color. And, you know, in many places, that is largely white workers have to be divided from black workers and other white workers, from Latino workers. White workers have to see themselves as different and set apart from. People of color have to see themselves different and set apart from. And one way that that happens is just through straight up, right, racist ideology, right? Of like white people being like, no black person's going to take my job. I believe that identity politics today functions to continue to keep those groups separate in a way that only benefits the ruling class. It is not a racist ideology. It's not built, but it fundamentally comes out of the same idea that there are totally irresolvable differences between these groups, and that certain groups actually, depending on what country you're in or what part of the country, or this country you're in, have interests that are separate from and even above and are benefiting from that system continuing. So I don't think identity politics feels progressive and sounds progressive and feels anti-racist and ultimately just keeps us separate and keeps us from figuring out how to organize together in order to get rid of the system that is oppressing all of us. Intersectionality, I do think it's very important that we talk about the oppression that people experience in layered and interacting and intersecting ways. Like, I think that's very important. That's part of the problem with, you know, with what's called the feminist movement now, or with feminism, right? Is not recognizing that the experiences of women of color are different from the experiences of white women. Or not recognizing the way having a trans feminine identity is very different from just from being a woman, but also needs to be included in the family of women more broadly. The problem with intersectionality is when class is just kind of like, to me, just kind of woven in there as one of those other identities, you know, as if being a member of the working class is the same as, you know, having a racial or gender identity. I don't think it is. I don't think it is not to be, because it's fundamentally, it's all of those other identities are serving to continue to support the class, the way that our class system is set up. All those other identities and the fact that we're divided by them supports the fact that we continue to have a working class that's the vast majority on the planet and is subjugated to a very, very, very tiny ruling class. So if it just kind of continues to be part of the thing, like gender oppression, racial oppression, class oppression, we have to stop racial oppression, we have to stop class oppression, then it kind of, I think, prevents us from seeing, like, actually, what is that linchpin that we need to focus on, and what's it going to require us to do? How are we going to have to learn to organize with each other in order to have revolution?
That, your buddy.
Yeah. Okay, you're on camera. Go over there. Down,
honey. Well, I know you said we can't really learn from distance learning, but honestly, that's probably the two most compelling descriptions of identity politics intersectionality that I don't know, you put it really well. So I learned something from you across the computer. So don't let anybody know.
I don't have any other questions at the moment. I don't know if you two have more, Andy and Kenny.
I have, maybe one more.
Yeah.
First off, what advice would you have for Kenny as a budding revolutionary and trying to walk this road? You know, you've been doing it for a while.
Mm.
And two, what is the road you're walking now? How would you describe it? And where are you headed now? I don't know, politically, personally, you know, you can just, well, how, where do you think you're headed?
Well, I'll start with that one because I don't know. Maybe that'll help Kenny. I have no idea. let's see. Well, I will say first, where am I and where am I headed? I can't answer that question without talking about, again, of coming out of the experience of being in the ISO and what it meant to be part of being in the organized revolutionary left that has so many problems in this country, because it has been a very very windy road so far, with a lot of going forward and back and turning around on the road and running in the other direction. And I think I have had to just continue to learn to be okay with that, to just realize that, you know, partly it is a function of, like, there was some damaging and really messed up shit that happened there. Partly it's just a function of when you got your crew, you feel more confident about what you're doing. You know, I don't have that. So it's not just all of the bad stuff that happened. It's that I'm isolated by myself. And so where I'm going is just kind of like, one thing I'm trying to do, which is part of the reason I'm glad that I had the chance to do this with y'all, is that I'm just trying to figure out what I think and be clear about it, you know? And I am at a point now where I know I can't do that by myself. And so just trying to talk to people and to write about it just for myself and try to be clear. What do I think? And I don't have to know, which is really nice that I don't have to know anymore, and that I can say these are the things that I really don't have the answers to. And, you know, where I'm headed is, I have no idea. I just kind of go towards the direction of what is animating me and ask, like, what is it about that particular struggle or that story or that petition or that fight or whatever, like, try to ask the question, why is that the thing that's drawing me towards it? Because there's usually an interesting political question in there for me to think about. And of course, I'm always going to talk to my coworkers, you know, whether I'm organizing in official capacity in a union or whether I'm the shop steward or not, I'm always going to be talking about, we need to go out on strike. Because like capitalism still being the problem, we do still need to just always go out on strike. It's never a bad time. but just the question to, like, who runs this place and why, you know, like, who's in charge here? You know, why do we have these bosses? What are they really doing? You know, who's paying the price in this situation? Who's getting it taken out of their hide and who isn't? Like, just those questions, I'm always going to be talking about those with my coworkers. I would say, like, it's hard being isolated. This show has been really important for me, really, really important for me. So I thank you. It really has. It's so isolating to hold these ideas that you don't read or see or hear anywhere else, to be able to actually, like, hear somebody talking about and to see people debating, you know, with each other, and to have, you know, Andy's saying things I usually agree with and Eduardo sometimes saying things that I don't agree with, but
see,
are the things
I was right. I was right. Thank you. That's envious. End the episode.
Eduardo saying the things that the people I want to talk to are saying, right? Yeah. Like, Eduardo is saying the things that my coworkers are saying, that the people in my union are saying. Like, it's been really important just to know that I have a place to go to hear those conversations being had. And I would also say, read, keep reading. you know, and I had to kind of go back and like reclaim things that I had only read in the ISO. Like, I'm going to read this again now for myself without this, you know, idea that it was assigned for a study group or that we're going to try to find a way to make this apply to some struggle that we're in. Those things are still really inspiring to go back and read, you know, Communist Manifesto, read little pieces of Capital. Right now I'm reading W.E.B. Du Bois, Black Reconstruction in America. Yeah, all right. Keep reading. At least for me now, I find inspiration in feeling connected to that lineage of ideas, because one of the things that I think is also hard about where we're at now is feeling like, oh man, our working class doesn't know shit. Like, we have been so stripped of our history of struggle, and people have fought and died for us over hundreds and hundreds of years, and we don't have that history. So I think the reading is also a really important part for me.
I forget how much I have put out there already that does make people think about. But what, like, colleagues of ours, or former colleagues of mine, and I cannot say they're mine, I don't work in the SCPSD anymore, but they do, I know the feel, the vibe, the climate of SCPSD teachers, and their arrogancy sometimes. Or the liberalism, the hard questions to, like, how do you, you know, there are the teachers who just want to go and teach, and the paras who are just trying to make a living, and the janitor workers who just want to focus on the work and get out, and then there are the teachers who just are so entrenched, they are entrenched in San Francisco politics, you know, they're so wrapped up in all of that bubblegum wrap of racism, you know, they're so wrapped up, you cannot get them out of that, you know, so, yeah.
I know that, like, we're so lucky that we're here thing, and sometimes I feel like this is not luck, like, you just, like you said, the wrappers are so thick, like, you can't see through it to see, like, what's really going on.
Anyhow, I have said enough. Thank you. I'm really appreciative of this conversation. Any of you two want to have any more questions for AJ? I'm
no, just that it's nice, because my partner Brandy, she's always like, I agree with Eduardo a little bit more here, da 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 da. It was finally, I get to hear somebody take my side.
And of course, it's just, they think I'm just your pawn.
No. Not after the last couple episodes. That cancel culture one.
All right.
You guys, yep.
Yeah,
it was good. I just listened to it the other day.
Awesome. And honestly,
Kenny, revolution right now.
And
right. I'll join your group, Kenny.
I think one thing I forgot to say, and Eduardo and Kenny, I don't know, AJ, I don't know what this is about you, but I saw it in our work in EDU. I saw it in your work in the ISO. But there is a way that you talk that is so effing convincing. I don't know what that character is about you. I don't know if it's because it's all coming out of being a worker and poor and stuff like this, but it's so effing grounded how you speak. And I think one thing I'm really have to really kind of remember, and I think this is important, is to not try to force an answer that I don't have. And to be much more try to be more comfortable when I'm like, I don't effing know, you know, because that is just the situation. And I think that's a mistake I make. Trying to come up with an answer when I'm not sure if I have one. And I think it'd be better just to sit back and go, I don't know if I have an answer here. So I appreciate you putting that out. But I'm just reminded how clear you speak. And I don't know what characteristic that is. It isn't just your words. I don't know. It's weird. But you guys know what I'm talking about?
I completely agree. I mean, like, obviously, I think the ideas that you shared, like, I agree. You know, basically, I do consider myself a socialist revolutionary because I don't see any other way, you know, to change things fundamentally. But yeah, I mean, I'm excited to show this to many people so that, you know, because I think you communicate your ideas very clearly in a simple way. Because I remember Lipson and I had a talk a while back that, like, he said that, you know, the smartest people make the complicated things simple. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's too complicated, then there's a problem with that. And I think that's been the problem with a lot of the, you know, like, even like Marxism and stuff. Is, you know, it's so long that people don't understand their own conditions, if you're dropping this complicated, you know, terminology, then you're going to turn them off. And like, and I myself, I found that useful because, you know, I'm trying to learn to speak like you, basically, because I talk with my mother. We have conversations about her union. My brother understands private property versus personal property because I'm asking more questions. But being less complicated, that's my point. Yeah, but I think, like, I'm going to study your the way you explain things and maybe plagiarize some of your ideas.
They're not mine. Take them. Yeah. I just came from somebody else.
I agree with them both. I think that this could be far reaching for some people if you're not bringing it down to a level where people can actually organize and use this work to bring down capitalism, then you're not going to do it because people are not, you're losing people. Mm-hmm. I have a question, AJ, for you. You worked and written work with Andy. How was that like now that I thought about it? Yeah.
Writing with Andy?
Yeah, you two wrote together. What was that experience like before I forget? Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, first I'll say at the beginning, I was so thankful because it was like in that time where I had, you know, I mean, we did some writing together when we were in the ISO, but I'm thinking mostly, you know, of what we did afterwards. And it was in that time where I just was like, I was just drifting. I was sad and drifting. And, you know, in the beginning, it was more like Andy's, I think, you know, it's like, I want to talk about this and run this down with somebody. You're the person I'm going to do it with. So I'm going to write this thing. I want you to take a look at that. I really appreciated it because it was like a lifeline, like keeping me in the work and thinking about it. And I also think that like writing with people is hard. Like writing is hard and writing with people is harder. It's like another layer of hard. I also find it really useful to kind of like, obviously, like I was saying before, writing to help clarify what you really think, but also to do the work of figuring out, like, what are the things that I can kind of leave the way that he said it, maybe is not the way I would have said it, but it's okay to leave that there. And what are the ones that are not? Like, finding those places really helps clarify ideas too. Because if it's something that maybe he just says it a little bit different, but if it's something I feel like that I can't really get with, then that helps figure out, there's probably something in there that we don't quite see eye to eye on, or there's a disagreement in there. It can be really, I think it's really useful.
Mm. And that was your experience too, Andy, maybe?
Yeah, and right. I think, I'm very proud of what we wrote. I think the biggest stuff was, the centerpiece of what we wrote was when we said we wanted to strike and it made everyone freak out, but we didn't lose ourselves. We just went ahead and said that. I'm really proud of the work that AJ and I did together, and it was really formative for me. So, and I think you can go back and read some of those things and be like, that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I think we would go farther now in saying some things, but I think actually it was definitely on the road to where, to my ultra left self now.
Yes, exactly. It's true. Once we kind of like crossed that line of, oh yeah, well, let's just go ahead and say it. This is what we think should happen. Strike. It's like, yep. It turns out there actually are other people who agree with that now too. Right. It helps you find them.
All right. Well, I guess this is good for me. I'm not sure if any of you want else, anything else you want to say, AJ, I think this is a good way to close. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Gosh, thanks so much, y'all. This was invigorating.
No, thank you. This is so awesome. And I mean, I think there'll be some issues to come back to, AJ, you know, about teaching, particularly teaching under a distance learning regimen, where you and I have talked about how depressing this may feel. I think we are going to be, it's going to be imposed on us. You know, I don't think we're going to have a fight around it, you know.
No.
So I really welcome being able to come back here and do this again on different issues. And certainly, I can tell you right now, you can pretty much call your shot on an episode you want us to have and be on. So, you know, I pretty much can do that anytime you want to say, I want to be on this episode talking about this. So y'all make that happen.
Oh yeah, sure, I'm sure that'll happen.
We were struggling to figure out for some future topics. Sometimes we don't know. So if you, or you know, if you're trying to see some, you see something you would like to bring up, you know, contact Andy or just let us know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do the outro now. If you are, depending how long you've listened to us, AJ, you've probably seen us evolutionize from when we had no outro, no intro. We just laughed off things.
Yeah.
And now we actually are very formal. Since Kenny came, thank God to Kenny.
He brought a level of professionalism.
Yes, to this. Kenny brought the professionalism to this.
You don't understand, AJ. You're being drawn into a criticism of me. That's what you're being drawn into. Don't go for it.
You know, the funny thing, though, that I think every time we have a guest, Eduardo wants someone to support him against Liz.
No.
He doesn't.
No. Es cierto.
No.
Okay. That does it for this week's episode. What's Left is a weekly political podcast as channel challenging the mainstream left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes wherever you found this episode or on our blog at what-s-left.webnode.com. You can find past episodes to this podcast as channel there and connect with us. I remind folks that if you like anything that you've heard here, please subscribe, share your favorite episode, rate, review, and subscribe all the time, everywhere, on any of our six platforms now, on iTunes Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, BitChute, YouTube, or Spotify. And if you would like to give us feedback about something you've heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-host Andy Lipson and Kenny Cepeda. And a big thank you, AJ, for joining us.
Yeah.
And see you all next time.
Bye-bye. Ciao.
And if you felt like you said something, you're like, I don't know if I liked what I said. I kind of took some chances there and I don't like how it came out. You'll just remove it.
And then you and Eduardo argue about what stays in and then he tells you to take things out and you don't.
How did you hear that?
I watched the show. Oh. Happens on the show all the time.
Oh my, I thought
out and you leave it in.
Yeah.
And you can imagine how pleasant an experience that is for Eduardo to be arguing with me about that.
Yeah,
you,
for sure.
I think you can imagine how much fun that is for him.
Oh, I can. Eduardo, with you. I know how that is.
He wants to leave everything in.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.